I gained friendships that started from kindergarten and last to this day. My parents' generation can say the same thing. To some, it was one of the most dangerous places in the city. To us, it was the only community we knew and called home. I was once convinced the term disadvantaged youth was a proper title for young people deemed unable to achieve success because of their environment or social class. That they were less likely to have, let alone achieve, their goals. I remember being referred to as a disadvantaged youth by educators, if and when they did come to my school. I did not like how it made me feel. I once believed there were certain things beyond my reach because of my upbringing, because I'm female, and because of my skin color. But then I realized this term did not define me. I began to see it as the reason I would prove them all wrong. I am a disadvantaged youth who now has 3 college degrees, 2 in architecture. How does a designer shape inclusion? I would sum it up with a Latin expression, nihil de nobis sine nobis, or nothing about us without us, which was made prominent by the disability rights movement. This phrase personifies the idea of designing with a community, that no course of action should be decided without total contribution from the people affected by that course of action, especially groups of people who have been socially excluded, categorized by disability or cultural heritage. This expression has largely been disregarded in relation to design. As an example, I recently rode the new Q Line transit system in Detroit. The design of this service emphasizes electronic forms of payment. When it first opened, none of the kiosks offered instructions on how to pay with cash, a secondary option that was only available inside a train. This alienated people in the city who must use change or cash. As a result, it became a way to transport a certain class of people from midtown to downtown and bypass those excluded people. It rides alongside the city bus, stopping at the same traffic lights, held up in the same traffic. I have personally experienced the outcomes of designing for a particular demographic. The results can be oppressive and unjust. Inhabitants are made to feel powerless and dependent. What's your approach to inclusion? While studying architecture, I realized I learn in ways that are different from many of my peers. I did fine in high school, but had a hard time adjusting to college. There was a disconnect between my thought process and how coursework was presented to me. A lot of students with similar upbringings run into this issue and might think that design is not for them. I need to take the time to get to the root of a problem before I can try solving it. I have to see the big picture and how things flow together. Making sense of how things are related to each other helps me make it personally meaningful. I also find meaningful connections by meeting with people who are going to be affected by the design. My passion is to create an entirely new leadership base for architecture so that the profession reflects the communities we serve. Diversity paired with passionate creativity improves the quality of life. It should outweigh this superhero approach to design that we have today. How do you make design accessible? There was a student who was struggling in one of our architecture workshops. The task was to create a city block using Lego pieces. She didn't have a logic behind why she laid out her city block in a particular way. As designers, we try to have some kind of reason for what we did and some kind of concept that we start with, rather than jumping to a design and then rationalizing why we did it. You get to a design because something led you there. I asked her to think back to something that was emotional for her. She had placed a lot of stores along the front of the city. She explained that shopping was something that she did with her mom when she was alive. I knew right then that she had an emotional story to tell. We talked as she created this block filled with things that she liked to do with her mom. She didn't have to understand design thinking. She just needed to take a step back and clarify the reason why she was making certain choices. Why is this needed? Why is this important? I want to make architecture and design feel reachable for kids in neighborhoods like the ones I grew up in. This includes them engaging with someone who's from the same type of neighborhood, someone who has defeated the same odds they face and became successful. When she describes inclusion, Round focuses on the greater context, the historical moments that led to an existing design, the orientation between designers and users, the leaders who initiate wide-sweeping changes. Above all, her lens highlights the key to making inclusive solutions, including the expertise of excluded communities. When people are excluded by mismatched designs, they grow intimately familiar with the nature of the exclusion and how it might be resolved. Given the opportunity, they can apply this expertise toward building inclusive solutions. The next chapter demonstrates how someone who understands the mismatch can resolve it in creative ways, and how this differs from a person who tries to make a solution based on stereotypes or benevolent pity for someone they perceive as unlike themselves. Takeaways: how generations of exclusion are made and broken. Exclusion habits. Creating mismatched interactions and obstacles to leadership positions that influence design decisions. In particular, barriers that aren't directly correlated to the skills of the profession, such as financial requirements, rigorous scheduling, or only offering one format of a test to gain credentials. How to shift toward inclusion. Zoom out. Consider the system of relationships that led to a solution. Ask how previous designs might be important to future designs. Identify a personal connection to an aspect of inclusion that is meaningful to you and your community. Study the history of how a solution came to be. Why is it shaped a particular way? Who influenced those decisions? And what was their motivation? 6. Matchmaking. How exclusion experts resolve mismatches. There's a rise in interest in designs that have a positive social impact. A number of projects are focused on designing for a community of people that's presumed to be disadvantaged. New technologies for students in developing countries, design contests to create solutions for elderly people or people with disabilities. While these are often well-intentioned, there are some potential pitfalls to designing for people with this superhero victim or benefactor-beneficiary mindset. It can lead to specialized solutions that cater to stereotypes about people. Us and them. To illustrate the problem, let's consider the Dodge LaFemme, a car designed specifically for women, brought to market in 1955 and canceled in 1956. The car was pink, inside and out, decorated with small roses. It featured a fully equipped matching purse that fit into the back of the passenger side headrest. It was marketed with the headline, "By special appointment to Her Majesty, the American Woman." While it's somewhat easy to dismiss this as an artifact of a bygone era of male chauvinism, let's also consider the failed launch of Bic for Her in 2012. This was a line of pens designed specifically for women that were thinner than standard pens and available in pastel shades of pink, purple, and turquoise. It was marketed on Amazon as having an elegant design just for her and a thin barrel to fit a woman's hand. Thin barrel or not, the pens are now a hallmark example of how not to design and market your product to women, thanks to writer Margaret Hartman, who sparked thousands of people to write entertainingly sarcastic reviews on Amazon.com. The product was quickly removed from market. In a more serious example, the automotive industry conducts safety testing with models of humans, also known as crash test dummies. For decades, these models were made to match the average male body type, though it was widely known that women were significantly more likely to be injured in a car accident. In 2011, the federal government started an initiative to reduce demographic disparities in public health. Car accidents ranked high on the list of public health risks. Passenger side safety ratings plummeted as cars were tested with a petite female crash test model that was 4 feet 11 inches tall and 108 pounds. That year, studies revealed that a female driver wearing a safety belt faced a 47% higher risk of death or serious injury than a male driver. Decades of design choices were made based on average male size testing standards. Engineers and designers were trained to optimize to these standards. It wasn't that the cars were suddenly less safe. They had always been less safe. It just hadn't been recognized as a problem. This wasn't a sex-specific disparity. The average male crash test model is 5 feet 9 inches tall and 172 pounds. Once the industry started using a range of body types in their safety testing, there was an improvement for any person whose body didn't match the design of the male crash test model across all genders, sizes, and ages. We can see from these examples how the deep perceptions people have about one another can be manifested in the design of products and environments. Many features of the most famous American cityscapes were constructed with a specific intention to exclude groups of people from social and economic opportunities. Even after those structures are demolished, retrofitted, or long gone, it's striking how an us-and-them mindset continues to manifest in the designs around us. Some designs are intentionally created to exclude groups of people. It isn't always a matter of mindlessness or forgetting to consider a community, but a targeted act of discrimination motivated by racism, ableism, sexism, classism, or related motivations to exploit power. Rectifying these forms of exclusionary design requires a shift in culture and a laser-sharp focus on changing the root of that exclusion. An unspoken hierarchy also appears when attempting to design solutions for groups that are perceived as needing help. Without an authentic and meaningful understanding of a person's life experiences, stereotypes can prevail. All too often, designers and architects perceive the recipients of their solutions as other people. This mindset distances the designers from people they perceive as disadvantaged beneficiaries of their design. The problem is separation. It's rooted in the ways we categorize human diversity. The most common ways that we group people by diversity are single dimensions like ability, gender, race, ethnicity, income, sexual orientation, and age. Even if we know that people are more complex than a single dimension, businesses regularly try to solve problems based on these monolithic groupings. Many of these demographic categories have more to do with business or social power structures than with how people actually interact with the world. It's unclear why a software designer needs to know the gender identity of a customer or whether or not they have two X chromosomes in order to create a better way to organize photos. Unchecked, assumptions about any group of people, especially when treated as a monolithic group, might misdirect us toward ineffective, even offensive, solutions. How we categorize people shapes how we make. With a growing interest in participatory design methods across many professional fields, how is that participation to be facilitated? What kinds of questions do you lead with? Do you meet people in their homes or require them to visit your office? What tools do you ask them to use when providing input to the design, and are they comfortable using them? Meaningful inclusion is much more than hosting listening tours, focus groups, or interviewing people on the street. One way to start is by building an extended community of exclusion experts who contribute to your design process. These are people who experience the greatest mismatch when using your solution, or who might be the most negatively affected. Develop meaningful relationships with communities that contribute to a design. Designing with, not for, excluded communities is how we put the inclusive in inclusive design. Disruptive change. In the pursuit of innovation, it's common for teams to focus solely on the functional elements of design. It's equally important to understand the emotional considerations of a design, in particular, the familiarity people have already developed with an existing solution. What are their patterns of using a solution? What makes these patterns important to their lives? Consider a person who takes a carefully planned path through a city to make it on time to work every day, or the ways they organize important files in their personal computing devices. Something as simple as changing the name of a feature in a software application or a street name in a city could be disorienting for them. This exclusion habit is often motivated by economic factors. Change for the sake of newness, growth for the sake of progress, delight for the sake of differentiation, fixing perceived disorder into order. Along the way, design changes can disrupt human patterns and relationships, especially when the problem solver, whether an architect, designer, engineer, or business leader, presumes that their own professional expertise supersedes the life expertise of people who are affected by those changes. The same thing happens in digital spaces when we change products that people are familiar with. Each time we change a design, by adding new features or moving things around, we require people to learn something new. They have to form new relationships and new patterns of behavior. The problem is, everyone adapts in their own ways. Not everyone solves problems or learns through the same approaches. But when designers make changes to a product or space, their ability biases can lead the way. As an example, while at Microsoft, I received a phone call one evening from a product leader who was concerned that there were far fewer women using their product than they expected. He was also concerned by the early solutions that teams were proposing to address the issue. We took a closer look at the patterns of behavior that were happening in the product. We studied the research of Oregon State University professor Margaret Burnett, who has spent over a decade studying the relationship between gender and software. In her GenderMag project, Dr. Burnett identified a set of facets that consistently lead to differences in how software is used by persons identifying as women or men. One facet in particular stood out to us: how people prefer to learn. Dr. Burnett also refers to this as a person's willingness to tinker with new software. She describes a spectrum that spans between two approaches to learning new technology. On one end is a preference to learn through a guided approach or with the assistance of a human being. On the other end is a high willingness to explore a software interface through trial and error. The research showed that people who identified as women distributed relatively evenly across the spectrum. There was a wide range of learning styles that different women used when learning new software. People who identified as men, however, clustered heavily toward the end of the spectrum for tinkering and troubleshooting solutions. This insight helped us reframe the problem. Was it possible that our product favored a particular learning style? We restructured our research to recruit people by learning style and interviewed people from multiple genders, including transgender participants. We found that people who preferred a guided learning approach, regardless of gender, felt alienated and confused by recent changes we made in the product. They were concerned that important programs had disappeared, or they couldn't figure out how to complete tasks they'd known how to do for years because the interface had changed. It turned out that when we updated our product, we required people to learn something new. But we did so in a way that reflected our own internal learning styles. This differed from how many of our customers learned. After all, what percentage of the general population is trained to think like engineers? Design decisions were made with the assumption that people would just hunt around and try things until they found what they needed, reflecting our team's own learning styles and disproportionately benefiting men. A sense of belonging. This ties back to Brown's insight about her own ways of learning. It isn't about needing help. It's about making a personal connection. Guided learning is one way for people to understand why a solution works the way it does, which helps them feel more confident in their abilities to utilize a solution. We applied inclusive design and sought out customers across genders who preferred a more guided learning approach. The process was similar to seeking out people who have ability biases that complement the dominant ability biases of our teams. These conversations helped us understand elegant ways to connect customers to existing product guidance and present it in ways that were relevant to the task they were trying to complete. Even more importantly, the engineering and design teams were united around the idea that we could tangibly include customers who could fill the gaps in our own knowledge. We isolated what we didn't know and sought out this expertise from customers who felt alienated. Then we asked thoughtful questions and let their answers change our design process. Disruptive changes can especially be an issue for people with disabilities who might depend on a particular technology to complete essential tasks in their lives. If a software program or website is updated, but the right steps aren't taken to ensure the updates are compatible with assistive tools like screen readers, the resulting changes can literally prohibit someone from doing their job, or prevent them from using a form of transit that they need to get to work on time. A change to a payment system can impact a person's livelihood. These learning biases can be further reinforced by feedback from customers. Many companies depend on their most engaged users, people who love products as much as the people who make them, to spend time providing feedback. How feedback is collected often reflects the preferences of the team that builds the product. As you might imagine, if you only take online feedback or only provide customer support in English, the only people you'll hear from are people who match this profile. This has a profound impact on which feedback makes its way to the design team. These feedback channels can also be a signal to customers that they either do or don't belong with the product. With technology, many customers have a tendency to blame themselves for not being able to figure out the changes on their own. Common indicators are customers who say, "I feel like technology is moving so much faster than I am," or, "I'm probably not smart enough to figure this out." In essence, they feel excluded. The impact on people can be deeply emotional. Shifting that sense of exclusion requires careful attention to who's missing from a solution and from feedback channels. Whose voices are the loudest, and whose are missing? Seek out who's missing and learn about their existing patterns of behavior. Design solutions that bring them successfully through your changes. Provide a diversity of ways to get guidance on what's new, and help customers get reoriented with the product they've known and used for years. We can also shift the sense of belonging by opening up the ways that people can contribute to the design process itself. Contributing to the design of a product or environment, even in the smallest ways, increases the emotional connection between a person and that solution. The push to accelerate growth and change for cities or software is often necessary, but how it is implemented is vitally important. People create emotional connections to a design that make a place or a product feel like their own. Introducing change isn't just about breaking apart concrete or bits of code. It's breaking apart human relationships. The result may be that people will leave and never return. Making a change without disrupting a sense of belonging can be difficult. It's a challenge because it's an emotional choice, not just a rational one. Those emotional considerations are best described by the people who are most excluded from your solution, or those who stand to lose the most during times of change, including kids who will interact with the next generation of designs. Their contributions will be one of your greatest resources in designing where to go next. My house, my rules. Leaders can be powerful advocates for creating inclusion. They set the house rules. Although leadership can come from anyone in a team, there is a unique responsibility for people at the most senior levels of an organization. They must be willing to do the personal work of understanding inclusive design. Certainly, there are functional investments that are important, but a senior leader can make or break a culture of inclusion. When someone in a leadership position declares they are committed to inclusion, some people will be inspired to follow. Others will be skeptical after years of knowing the opposite to be true. And absolutely everyone will be waiting for what happens next. People are often caught off guard after they declare a commitment to inclusion. The first thing they need to contend with is everything that isn't inclusive. It will show up and make itself known. How a leader listens to, learns from, and invests in shifting these exclusions will be the greatest indicator of their true intentions. Here are four considerations for leaders who want to improve the inclusion of their team. Make promises that you can keep. Acknowledge the current state of inclusion in your organization and address fundamental issues of access before moving on to other areas of inclusion. Greater damage to inclusion comes from declaring it a promise while having no plans for how to implement the change, or building new innovations on top of systems that lack basic accessibility. A broken promise is more detrimental than making no promise in the first place. set an expectation that inclusion is a long game. Balance the cultural history that led us to where we are today with the reasons why inclusion matters to the future of an organization. Have measured plans for how to address entrenched exclusion habits. These have to account for the trade-offs and resources that need to be made in order to build inclusive solutions. Specific people need to be accountable for completing the work. The work is hard and the road is long. But as progress begins to happen, inclusion can be one of the strongest ways to mobilize people around a shared purpose. The work is meaningful, not just because it benefits overlooked communities, but because it can drive new ideas for growth with untapped ingenuity and fresh thinking. Create a system of incentives and rewards that will motivate people to make inclusive designs. If the incentive structure for an engineer, designer, or marketer specifically calls out rewards for making inclusion a priority at the beginning of the design process, it demonstrates that an organization is truly committed to inclusion. If investments in inclusion, like accessibility, are treated as an added tax, paying that tax will always be deferred in favor of other business priorities. What we measure shows what we value. Bring people along in the process. Create a diversity of ways for people to contribute to changing your perspective as a leader. Apply the power of your leadership position to uplifting the excluded communities that are affected by your choices. It isn't organic. It doesn't happen purely through goodwill. It takes intention, planning, and stamina. Connecting people. Inclusive solutions connect people, whether they're in a neighborhood or somewhere on the internet. The solutions that we build can be economic catalysts for excluded communities. Cities and technologies can bridge people to better opportunities through access to work, education, and social resources. But how we go about making those solutions sets the stage for who benefits from the opportunities. This is what distinguishes inclusive growth from growth that only benefits a few. Design influences how people view themselves and their community. The outcomes of design carry the imprints of the professionals who crafted them. They are scratched and scored by the remnants of their creators' thought processes and assumptions. Even after the architect or designer is long gone, their mark endures. The generations of people who live with those designs every day can tell you the exact ways in which that design was a success and a failure. In times of growth and revival, how we go about creating our solutions can be the difference between perpetuating or transforming the cycle of exclusion. Moments of change are the ideal time to focus on inclusion. The key to success is matching great design challenges with great guidance from exclusion experts. Takeaways: how exclusion experts resolve mismatches. Exclusion habits. A for others or superhero mindset, where pity and stereotypes influence design decisions without any meaningful contribution from excluded communities. A top-down approach to making decisions, presuming that professional expertise supersedes life experience. Disregarding existing patterns of familiarity in pursuit of growth. Change for the sake of change. How to shift toward inclusion. Identify exclusion experts. These are people who stand to lose the most or face the greatest mismatches with any changes you make to a solution. Design with, not for. Facilitate meaningful ways for exclusion experts to contribute to your design process. Understand the emotional value that people have already invested in an existing solution. Incorporate these emotional considerations as you create new designs. Maintain an ongoing community of exclusion experts who can fill your own gaps in perspective. Build relationships with local organizations that support excluded communities. Understand the role your product plays or could play in people's lives. Review the techniques you use to collect, sort, and analyze customer feedback. Analyze how the design of that system determines who is willing and able to contribute feedback. Whose voice is loudest? Whose is missing? 7. There's no such thing as normal. Testing our assumptions about human beings. Always remember that you are absolutely unique, just like everyone else. Dr. Margaret Mead, pioneer in cultural anthropology. How many different kinds of human beings are there in the world? If we aim to create solutions that benefit millions, even billions of people, our solutions need to work across a wide range of human diversity. But that's easier said than done. People can be highly unpredictable. How do we design for so much complexity? A common exclusion habit is to oversimplify who uses or receives a solution. And then we forget to add human diversity back into our design process. Designers use many techniques to envision masses of people. Many of them are plagued by one dangerous idea: the normal human. Our notions of normal were heavily influenced by a 19th century Belgian astronomer and mathematician, Adolphe Quetelet. Here's a quick peek into that story, derived from Todd Rose's exceptional book, The End of Average. Quetelet had ambitions to be as well known as Isaac Newton. Newton's laws of motion and thermodynamics had brought certainty to seemingly unpredictable phenomena in the universe. Probability and mathematical prediction grew in popularity, sparking new fields of science. Quetelet turned his ambition toward a new pursuit: using mathematical methods to make sense of uncertainty in human society. He started measuring human beings and amassing that data into statistical models. There was one mathematical model that dominated Quetelet's approach: the Gaussian distribution. It's more commonly known as the bell curve. Carl Friedrich Gauss, a German mathematician, developed the proof of a concept that had been introduced decades earlier by Abraham de Moivre, a French mathematician and contemporary of Newton's. Gauss proved that the probability of an event, like the positioning of an astronomical object or the flipping of a coin, could be drawn as a normal curve, and that the average, or vertical midline of that curve, gave the closest representation of the true nature of that event. The bell-like shape of a normal curve makes it easy to recognize. Quetelet gathered data on human bodies, such as height-to-weight ratios and rates of growth, across thousands of people in Belgium and surrounding areas of Europe. He plotted that data and was astonished to find they mapped to bell curves. Invigorated by his discovery, Quetelet started measuring many more aspects of human beings, creating physical, mental, behavioral, and moral categories of people. Everywhere he looked, he found bell curves. He became consumed with what he deemed the human ideal, the perfect average measurement across all those dimensions. Quetelet described the perfect face, height, intelligence, moral character, and beyond. If the average man were completely determined, we might, as I have already observed, consider him a type of perfection, and everything differing from his proportions or condition would constitute deformity and disease. When he published his Treatise on Man, it was a revolutionary work. In its pages, he held that individual people should be measured against that perfect average. From this comparison, one could calculate the innate degree of abnormality in an individual person. Diversity and variations in human beings were treated as degrees of error from perfection. The idea was contagious and enduring. The bell curve was used to revolutionize existing fields of study and sparked entirely new ones, especially in the social sciences. Normal-based methods of diagnosing illness led to advancements in public health. Quetelet's body mass index, BMI, is still used in many areas of the world to advise individuals on their degree of obesity or fitness. Eugenics, and its horrific assertions about the superiority of select abilities, races, and classes of people, were born out of an idolization of Quetelet's perfect average human. The conclusions that were derived from Quetelet's approach were used to strengthen the power of some human beings and to dehumanize others. The power of the bell curve still echoes through the design of our society, from classrooms to computers. Left-handed students are seated in desks made with the assumption that normal human beings are right-handed. Important features of smartphone applications are placed based on where the average user, also presumably right-handed, is likely to reach for them. A common shorthand for this mindset is the 80-20 rule. Originally created by Italian economist Vilfredo Pareto, who demonstrated that 80% of the land in Italy was owned by 20% of the population. Joseph Juran, a pioneer in the field of quality management, translated Pareto's insight into a rule for quality control, stating that 80% of problems come from 20% of causes. In essence, he was separating the vital few key sources to a problem from the useful many potential sources to a problem. Over time, many design teams have conflated the 80-20 rule with the bell curve. The common misconception is that the center of the curve represents an 80% majority of the population and 80% of the important product problems to solve. The presumption is that if we design a solution that fits the largest bulk of the curve, the middle average, our solution will work well for the majority of people. This leads many teams to treat the remaining 20% as outliers or edge cases, a category of work that is often deferred or neglected. In fact, edge cases can be a useful starting point for creating better solutions. Many exclusion experts use solutions in ways that resemble edge cases. But an edge case implies the existence of a normal average human. When it comes to design, what if this average human is simply a myth? Everyone and no one. Rose provides a vivid example from the history of the United States Air Force, USAF. In the 1940s, the first fighter jets were designed to fit the average pilot. The USAF measured hundreds of bodily dimensions across thousands of pilots and used the averages of that data to design the instruments of the flight deck, or cockpit. Every feature of that flight deck was fixed in place, without adjustability. The assumption was that any individual pilot could adjust himself to overcome the gap in reaching any element of the flight deck that wasn't a perfect fit for him. However, the Air Force was experiencing a high rate of crashes that couldn't be attributed to mechanical failure or pilot error. A lieutenant and researcher, Gilbert Daniels, studied just 10 of those human dimensions that were used in the design of the original flight deck. He measured 4,000 pilots to confirm how many of them fit all 10 dimensions. The answer was zero. Not a single pilot matched all 10 dimensions. Everyone differed in at least one way. In essence, the USAF had designed a flight deck for everyone and no one. This led to the development of new design principles based on individual fit. Innovations like adjustable seatbelts, seat heights, and positioning of controls. Once the instruments of a flight deck could be modified by an individual pilot, their safety and performance improved. The adjustments also drastically increased the number and diversity of people who qualified to be fighter pilots. These advancements have influenced the design of many more industrial products. Every time you ride in a car and move your seat, seatbelt, or mirrors into a position that works best for you, you're benefiting from these original innovations and individual fit. The fighter jet example underscores how designing for the average serves no one, whether the design is the shape of a desk or a curriculum that emphasizes specific ways of learning. Many designs make people feel like those first pilots, adapting themselves in extreme ways in order to use a mismatched design. The idea of a normal human being was constructed out of the ambitions of a 19th century mathematician. It was used to make meaningful advancements in some areas of society and used to great detriment in others. Most importantly, what if the idea simply wasn't true? All people are variable over the course of their lives. What if our minds and bodies were simply unpredictable? Which human, exactly, should be at the center of human-centered design? Human-led, beyond human-centered design. Personas are a common tool that designers and marketers employ when thinking about who will use their product. A persona is a description of a mythical person backed by large amounts of research data. The persona might join a name like Janet, with an image of a woman on a poster next to a description that states, "I'm a soccer mom and freelance consultant who coordinates my family's calendar and has limited time to learn about new technology." or the smiling face of a man sitting at a computer next to the words, "I'm Jim. I'm the lone information technology professional at a startup, and I always want to keep up with the latest gadgets." Like bell curves, personas aim to minimize the uncertainty that's inherent in trying to understand a large group of people. Personas were created to remind designers and engineers that they're building solutions for someone other than themselves. While well-intentioned, personas oversimplify people without clear direction on how or when to add human diversity back into the design process. Designers are also taught that the long tails of a bell curve are the edge cases of how people will use their solutions, the exceptional uses. Issues related to accessibility in particular are treated as part of that long tail. The bell-curved mindset mistakenly leads us to believe that the market opportunity for accessibility is minimal. Accessibility is treated as an extreme of otherwise normal design. In Chapter 8, we will review examples that disprove this assumption. If there is no normal user, there is also no extreme user. There is no such thing as people on the far reaches of the curve. There is no abnormal scenario. There is no edge case. Rather, we need new tools to represent human diversity and challenge entrenched habits of designing for the average. When personal computers first rose to popularity, it made sense to design graphic interfaces for those computers based on wide-sweeping generalizations about people. Typically, they imagined one person using one computer in one environment, completing one or two tasks at a time. In these early days of digital technology, the variability from one user to the next was also relatively low. Most people were novices at using computers to write an essay or create a spreadsheet. Therefore, it was somewhat easy to make general assumptions about who was using the computer, how they would be interacting with it, and their level of skill. Likely, they would be seated in front of a screen and typing on a keyboard in a relatively quiet environment. Using these assumptions, it made sense for computers to be visually and cognitively demanding, with arrays of icons on a desktop requiring people to hunt for tiny controls hidden in obscure locations. Today, however, unpredictability in how people use technology is higher than ever. Interactions with technology have undergone an explosion in diversity. Nearly every industry is rethinking their business, products, and services through the lens of digital transformation. It's a necessary consideration for many businesses that hope to remain competitive in the 21st century. One person might have dozens of interactions with digital interfaces in the course of one day, and not just using a smartphone. People interact with digital interfaces when they buy groceries, follow directions in a car, take a train, buy a cup of coffee, apply for a job, learn a lesson in school, or check out a book at the library. They use computers in movie theaters, sun-filled parks, noisy cafes, in the rain, and to set bedtime music for their babies. Sometimes they want absolute silence so they can focus. Sometimes they want to be interrupted with an urgent notification from a loved one. This means technology needs to be more than smart. It has to be appropriate to a given person for a specific time, place, and purpose. It can be overwhelming to even think about such diversity. How can we design for so much uncertainty as people move between environments and devices? We won't get there on math alone. It's indisputable that mathematical models are a cornerstone of technology design. It's incredibly useful to determine patterns across large groups of people. But when is it appropriate to apply these models to individual human beings? Math has its limits. Describing human individuality is one of those limits. If our aim is to create solutions that are beneficial in people's lives, there are potentially harmful consequences to trying to understand humans solely through math. Technology has a lot to learn from humans, in particular, from humans who have a deep understanding of mismatched interactions. Their expertise guides better questions as well as better solutions. Learning from human expertise. Dr. Margaret Mead is often credited with transforming how we study human cultures. She brought attention to the role that culture plays in shaping individual personality. She helped popularize cultural anthropology, and at the time of her death was one of the most famous anthropologists in the world. She called out inherent biases in intelligence tests at a time when many sociologists were churning out studies in attempts to prove racial and gender superiority. While Quetelet-like methods inspired many academics to pursue bell-curved conclusions about humans, Mead conducted deep studies of cultures that were vastly different from her own. She spent extensive periods of time living with and observing the native cultures of Oceania, especially in Papua New Guinea. An excerpt from the New York Times 1978 obituary of Dr. Mead reads, "Her conclusions were based on detailed observation, and if she did not conduct anthropometric tests or produce statistical surveys, she did convey her subjects graphically. Dr. Mead settled down with the people she was studying. She ate their wild boar, wild pigeon, and dried fish, helped to care for ill children, and gained the confidence of her informants. At one time, she built a wall-less house so she could observe everything around her. She possessed a trait unusual in anthropologists of her time, an ability to shed her Western preconceptions." Dr. Mead focused on participation as a way to reveal patterns and conclusions. As she learned, the people she studied were in the lead. They were the experts in being human. When Quetelet gathered data on humans, he was consumed with quantifying the face, body, and full character of a singular, ideal average man. His motivation was to fit all aspects of society to this average, while dismissing any human who deviated from that norm as abnormal. This motivation has endured, whether implicit or explicit, through generations of his intellectual descendants, including many current designers, engineers, and marketers. This matters more than ever as data science grows in prominence. All of us are feeding that growth by interacting with computers that record more information about our behaviors than ever before. But data is just data. It doesn't provide answers. The art of drawing conclusions from data is knowing how to collect, organize, and make sense of it. Taking time to qualify human depth and complexity, even with a relatively small number of people, can help balance the shortcomings of big data. Thick data is gathered information that explains human behavior and the context of that behavior. It was first described as thick description by anthropologist Clifford Geertz in his book, The Interpretation of Cultures. Thick data is a way of understanding how people feel, think, and react, and their underlying motivations. Together, big data and thick data can give specific and measurable practices for reintroducing human diversity into the design process. For design, big data is like a heat map that can point out interesting areas to investigate. It sheds light on where patterns exist, especially when people use a solution in ways that don't match a designer's expectations. In complementary ways, thick data can help us zoom in and understand what's really going on. It helps reveal the underlying reasons why big data patterns exist. It helps us identify the human behaviors that contribute to large trends. Big and thick data can work together to help us understand areas of exclusion in products and environments. It's challenging, if harmful, to pursue one universal model to guide how we think about all humans. But it is possible to understand in great depth a particular problem worth solving for one person. The persona spectrum. Earlier, we examined the distinction between inclusive and universal design. The former emphasizes one-size-fits-one solutions. The latter emphasizes one-size-fits-all. The persona spectrum is an inclusive design method that solves for one person and then extends to many. Consider the rise of television, a visual and audio medium. Captioning was initially created in the early 1970s by the National Bureau of Standards and ABC to make television content accessible to deaf and hard of hearing communities. In 1972, Julia Child's The French Chef aired on PBS as the first television episode with captioning. Today, roughly 360 million people in the world are deaf or have profound hearing loss. 32 million of them are children. Nearly everyone, given a long enough lifespan, loses their hearing as they age. Captioning and subtitles are essential tools for making information accessible to millions of people, and many more people benefit from these solutions. In noisy airports or crowded pubs, patrons rely on captioning to access sports and news. Captions are increasingly common in social media when we can't turn up the volume on our smartphones. They also assist new readers or people who are learning a new language. The solution initially addressed a mismatch between television audio and the deaf community. It went on to benefit many more people with hearing loss because of age, injury, or environment. The persona spectrum can help us create inclusive designs in repeatable ways. Imagine a spectrum of permanent, temporary, and situational mismatches that people experience based on their abilities and disabilities. These spectra could be drawn for any dimension of human physical, cognitive, emotional, and societal abilities. It all depends on the problem you're trying to solve and the ways that people might interact with that solution. The persona spectrum starts with the person who experiences the highest degree of mismatch. For example, if you were designing a charging station for an electric vehicle, you would certainly need to consider how it would work for any driver who was born with one arm. There would be a lot to learn from talking with people about how well existing gasoline fuel pumps work. A design that works well for someone who's born with one arm would also benefit someone who has a temporary arm injury, like a broken elbow, or even someone who is holding a cup of coffee. But you can also learn a lot by spending time with someone who's blind to understand how they navigate existing payment kiosks for buying groceries or bus tickets. This perspective is also important for a time when self-driving electric cars become mainstream and will need to work well for people who are blind. A persona spectrum is more than just a continuum of ability. It's about understanding why people across a spectrum want to access that solution. An example of this important nuance is Hearing AI, a project initiated by a Microsoft developer, Sweta Machanavajala. One day, her neighbor showed up at her front door, angry about the loud sound coming from Machanavajala's apartment. It was her carbon monoxide detector. Machanavajala, who has profound hearing loss, hadn't heard it. The experience inspired her to build an application that could alert the user to sounds in their environment. Taking an inclusive design process, her team learned from a range of people who were deaf and hard of hearing. They learned about the importance of deaf culture and participated in American Sign Language classes and events. An important theme emerged. No one was interested in a solution that attempted to fix or replace an ability to hear. The functionality of telling people what a sound was, like a crying baby or a honking horn, felt like an inappropriate attempt to fix a person's deafness. Rather, people were interested in the emotional information that would guide them to make their own conclusions about the nature of a sound. For example, knowing whether the inflection in a person's voice meant that they were being sarcastic or being angry. As a result, Sweta and team built a solution that visualized the intensity of a sound and the direction it was coming from so that a user could turn in that direction and determine what it was for themselves. Tying back to the persona spectrum, it's important to understand what motivates a person to use a solution. Rarely, it is a purely functional reason, like knowing the identity of a sound. More often, they are motivated by some universal human need, like an increased sense of independence or creating an emotional connection. These motivations are the glue that connects people across a persona spectrum. When we design for one person who experiences mismatches in using a solution, we can extend the benefits of that design to more people by asking who else might want to participate but is excluded on a temporary or situational basis. A persona spectrum can improve the inclusion of existing solutions, extend seemingly niche solutions to broader populations of people, and future-proof your design. Cognitive, sensory, and societal mismatches. These introductory persona spectra focus heavily on physical mismatches. Exclusive designs are equally prevalent in cognitive, sensory, and societal areas. Sometimes they can be more challenging to recognize, while a physical barrier often literally stands in your way. These other types of mismatches might be subtler. Here are a few thoughts on how we can extend the fundamentals of inclusive design beyond physical abilities. With digital experiences, cognitive mismatches are especially important to understand. The human mind is being influenced in so many new ways by applications that constantly compete for our attention, or augmented reality products that change how people perceive a combination of physical and virtual environments. Building a solution to fit how a person learns, remembers, focuses, uses language, or experiences sensations can be a complex design challenge. The diversity of the human brain and body is far from being fully understood. Yet there are a growing number of examples of cognitively inclusive products, many of them focused on education and learning environments. Some of these are built with the participation of people with cognitive and sensory disabilities. Others are focused on types of cognitive diversity that aren't disabilities. Societally, technology is a gateway to accessing economic and social opportunities, especially as people around the world join the internet for the first time. There are over 730 million people on the internet in China, roughly twice the population of the United States. 95% of internet users in China access it using mobile devices. Many people are joining the internet through voice-based computers, by talking to their devices as a primary mode of interaction. Augmented and virtual reality are quickly becoming primary ways to access the internet for millions of people in China.